At least once a month on a Wednesday, we like to take a look at what's going on in the area of biofuels and biofuels research. Today, many times we've talked about using corn grains to produce biofuels, but we're not going to zero in on that today. We're going to be talking about cellulosic biomass, about using cellulosic biomass in this process, and how important fermentation is in the production of biofuels. And three guests with us today. Tom Jeffries, one of our guests today, is a USDA professor in bacteriology and senior scientist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Audrey Gash is an assistant professor of genetics at the UW-Madison who works on yeast fermentation. And John Greenler has been with us once or twice in the past. I know he was with us at State Fair. I can remember that for sure. He's director of outreach and education for the Great Lakes Biofuels Research Center at the University of Wisconsin. So we're really pleased to have all three of our guests here today. And as we move along and talk with them, I know some questions are going to come up in your mind. And when they do, I hope you'll call us. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. That's the other way to get in touch with us, and we'll be glad to get your questions to our guest. John Greenler, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, Audrey Gash, welcome to you. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
And Tom Jeffries, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, John.
Well, John, you direct outreach and education for the GLBRC, as what we'll probably call the Great Lakes Biofuels Research Center. You've got a couple of hotshot researchers here today with us, too.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I mean, one of the great parts of my job is really getting to know all the different researchers in the center who are really doing some very interesting, exciting, and innovative research. There's lots of stories to tell, and that's one of the things we really want to bring to your audience is, you know, the kind of wide array of opportunities that are coming forward through the research of the center.
You know, one of the things that if I'd ask my friends, who I was with a bunch of people the other day, and if I'd ask them, which departments would have been involved in biofuels research? They probably, and I mentioned genetics, they probably would have said, no, there wouldn't have been anybody from genetics involved in something like biofuels research. Audrey, how are you involved?
Yeah, well, let me tell you, my lab researches yeast cells, and we in particular focus on yeast, how yeast cells survive environmental conditions, and we think a lot about yeast cells in nature and in different processes. And so I have a history in this type of research, and then when the GLBRC came along, of course, one of the things that we're trying to do is make ethanol production more efficient, more economical. And yeast, in fact, is the number one way that we make ethanol through fermentation. Yeast cells are great at converting sugar into ethanol. But there are some problems for what we're trying to do at GLBRC. And so that's where my research comes in and how I can contribute to this with my expertise in yeast biology and physiology.
All right. Well, we'll get some more from you on that. But I want to turn to Tom Jeffries for a minute, too. And Tom, how are you involved in all this?
Well, Larry, I've been working on biomass conversion since about 1975. And starting in, I guess, the early 80s, we discovered a group of yeast that would ferment 5-carbon sugars into ethanol. And 5-carbon sugars are a significant component of agricultural residues and hardwood species.
So not only corn that we're talking about here, but could be trees or could be all kinds of things.
Well, we tend to, yes, you can use trees, you can use woody residues, agricultural residues. It's estimated there's about 1.3 billion tons per year available in the U.S. in biomass, agricultural resources, and woody resources that could be converted into ethanol. And if we were able to capture and convert that, we could make 100 billion gallons of ethanol a year.
That's a lot. That'd be a lot of gas, isn't it? How much gas is used in the course of a year in the United States or even in Wisconsin?
Well, it would be about 40%, maybe higher, depending on what what the future growth of petroleum is in the United States. But by today's usage, it's about
40%. Well, we're never going to get 40%, John, are we?
Well, you know, a lot of it, you know, as Tom was saying, so much depends upon, you know, what our current consumption levels are, what kind of conservation practices we're adopting in parallel. So it's a very dynamic and complex system that we're really trying to move into. But I think the most important point is that we can really make a significant contribution to addressing our fuel needs and, I think, also very importantly, addressing the issue of climate change through reduced, carbon emissions as well. There's just a lot of factors that are going to need to, come together to really, give us that final sense of how far we can go. But there's no doubt that it's going to be very significant.
Okay. Well, we have some callers online. And again, if you would like to join in, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Will in Ashland is up first, so let's go to Will. Hi, Will.
Hi. My question's about terms and how you sort all of the different words that have been cropping up to describe things that are going on in this field. Bio seems to become the prefix that's being attached to everything. Biofuels, biomass, biodiesel, bioenergy, and there's probably more that belong on that bio list. So I'm curious what you all can say to listeners that help sort that mess.
Well, John, you want to start or...
Well, I think that's a very good point. And actually, there is kind of an even broader framework that one can use in this context, and that is the whole concept of a bioeconomy, because it really does even go beyond just energy considerations. There's a lot of uses of fossil fuels, oil, for example, that is for production in chemical and other processes. And this is a very kind of... key parallel opportunity that a lot of researchers are exploring in parallel. I mean, the production of compounds for use as energy alternatives. There's also a lot of other chemistries there that are going to be significant opportunities as well. So
I'll throw out another one.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
Biorefining. Okay, and this is a way of thinking about taking a biomass feedstock and obtaining the highest and best uses for each of its various components. We don't just take a barrel of oil and put it in an engine. We take the barrel of oil and we separate out into gasoline, into refiner components and things that we make plastics out of.
Sure.
And the same thing's true of biomass. When you harvest grain, for example, you don't just make ethanol. You also make distiller's dried grain solids that go into animal feeds, and you make oil, and you make vegetable oils, you make fiber. There are many things that you make out of the grain, and we can do the same thing with the lignocellulosic biomass. We can fractionate it. We can make the sugars. We can make the lignin from the sugars. We can make ethanol. We can make precursors for bioplastics, things like polylactides, things like 1,3-propanediol, which is a new commercial product that's being used by companies now to make fibers for carpets and clothing. So biorefining is a way of thinking about how to get the highest and best use. At the Forest Products Lab where I work, we're looking at using biorefining to separate out the hemicellulosic sugars from the cellulosic fiber that's in the wood so that we preserve the cellulosic fiber for paper production and we use the hemicellulosic sugars for fuel production.
Ah, interesting.
Larry, could I follow up?
You bet.
I'm curious if you three think that the term bioenergy is the best catch-all when you're trying to describe the full range of technologies and systems and approaches and fuels that are being pursued.
Hmm. Audrey, what do you think?
Well, I think the term bioenergy really refers to that which is derived from biological processes. So ethanol, biofuel, is considered a biofuel because it's made by yeast and made with plant material. And so there are many other technologies out there. We can think of electric vehicles that maybe aren't captured by the term bioenergy. So in my mind, bioenergy really refers to those processes that really are dependent on biological processes. So it doesn't capture all the alternative fuels.
Gotcha. All right. Thanks, Will. Thank you for calling. Jesse in Woodstock, Illinois, it's your turn next. Hi, Jesse.
Hi there. My question regarding, I'm just curious why there's such a huge obsession with using ethanol for fuel when there's existing technologies like biodiesel that can be cheaply produced in largely unusable land masses, like in the deserts, from algae, for instance, just one of many sources of where it can come from, and produce a more stable fuel that doesn't attract as much water into the fuel system, for instance, in a car engine as ethanol obviously does. And two, why aren't these existing systems more used and researched when there's solar and antennas, for instance, the amount of subsidies that go into corn production for ethanol, the amount of money that is needed to make something like a solar and antenna a reality and a viable energy producer is a pittance compared to the subsidies that go into agricultural production of ethanol. And I'm failing to be able to wrap my mind around the obsession with ethanol as a fuel compared to existing technology. And I'll take my comments off the air.
All right, Jesse, thank you very much. Tom Jeffries, let's turn to you.
Yes. Actually, I'm a big proponent of biodiesel, and I think that there are just a few little clarifying things we need to remember. First of all, most of the biodiesel in the United States is a byproduct of soybean manufacturing. In Europe, it's a byproduct of a different crop, but biodiesel is basically an oil seed, and it only amounts to between 5 and 15, sometimes as high as 30%, but rarely that high of the seed. And if you're only taking 10% of the seed, that means you still have 90% of that plant there. So even if you're growing biomass to make biodiesel, you still end up with a lot of supporting biomass that can be converted and used in other ways. Now, our caller talked about the use of algae, which has been investigated for over 30 years to use algae to grow and make basically a biodiesel oil or an algal oil. And yes, algae do store a lot of their photosynthate as oils in some species of algae. But it turns out that the amount of light penetrating into the water body where the algae is growing, it gets extinguished very quickly. Think about, you know, how thick is a leaf? A leaf is not that thick. Likewise, the light penetrating into the water body, it gets absorbed by the algae. And in order to recover that oil in the algae, you have to harvest the algae. That means you have to either sediment it or filter it or centrifuge it, and that takes a lot of energy for recovering. So yeah, there are promising areas out there, but there's still a lot of technical barriers.
If I could add one thing, I think the caller raises some really important points, but he described these in terms of ethanol fuel. And there's a very important distinction here. What most people are familiar with is corn-based ethanol production, and that's really gotten a bad rap. It's not the most efficient way to produce ethanol. What we at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, GLBRC, are trying to do is actually optimize making ethanol from other types of plant material, which is called cellulosic ethanol. Ethanol production, and that has many, many advantages over corn-based ethanol.
And we'll talk some more with our guests coming up in just a minute. Stay with us. Happy to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here as we talk biofuels and biofuels research with John Greenler, directs outreach and education for the Great Lakes Biofuels Research Center, the GLBRC, Great Lakes Biofuels Research Center at the UW-Madison. Audrey Gash is also connected with it, too. She's an assistant professor of genetics at UW-Madison, works on yeast fermentation. And Tom Jeffries, USDA professor in bacteriology at the UW-Madison and a senior scientist at the Forest Products Laboratory, also located in Madison. I failed to mention Forest Products earlier, and I'm glad to get that mention in because certainly they're very important in all this process as well. If you have a question for us as we move along today, I hope you'll join us. The number is 1-800-642-1234. And you can email us too. And the email address is talk@wpr.org. And Jeff in Waukesha has been waiting a while. So let's go to Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have property up north that's surrounded by hundreds of acres of paper land.
Oh, where'd you go? Where'd you go, Jeff? We lost Jeff. You know, Jeff had a question and Jim Packard is informing me relating to pulping waste and pulp waste material. And I'm guessing now here, but I'm guessing that his question was, what about pulp waste?
Right. We actually at the Forest Products Laboratory, we have a program called Value Prior to Pulping, in which we're taking woody materials and extracting the sugars in order to ferment the sugars and use the residual fibers for paper making. And we're hoping to increase the profitability of the existing pulp mills by doing this. It turns out that even though you produce a relatively small stream of ethanol, you can actually increase the profitability significantly in the mill. So we're working with a couple of pulp mills here in Wisconsin, hoping to be able to develop that process. There's also a number of ways that you can take waste materials from, say, sawmill operations or other operations for pelletizing. I mean, not all biofuels have to be converted into ethanol. You can gasify them, you can pelletize them, you put them in burners. So, yeah, there are a lot of other outlets.
And, you know, as an added value, I think as we look at the paper industry in this state and the problems that business has kind of come into in recent years, especially in the last few years, any extra profits that can be obtained is certainly a big help for those folks.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's go to – thank you again for calling, Jeff. I'm sorry – sorry we lost you here, but Kevin in Orfordville's on with a question as well. So let's go there. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Thanks for having this topic, and thanks for taking my call. I'm calling with regards to biofuels as a form of land management. I volunteer with Rock County Parks, and we have some property that we own that we're converting into prairie and oak savanna. And the resulting natural biomass of our area is wonderful biofuels. We're going to do some winter baling just to heat our house with prairie straw in our wood burner. Mm-hmm. So we can actually allow the wood to regenerate and use prairie straw in its stead. But I think it's important to show how you could actually improve, restore, and preserve large parts of Wisconsin using these renewable biofuels and the added benefit of having a natural perennial ecosystem to sequester carbon.
Mm. Well, I appreciate that call, and let's turn to John Greenler.
Yeah, you know, there's a wide range of different types of materials, biological materials that can be used to generate biofuels. And clearly today, you know, the current business is largely looking at corn grain. But, you know, as we move forward, you know, there's a number of different kind of dimensions of opportunity out there that take us into more perennial type crops and crops that potentially are polyculture in nature, where you have more than one type of plant being grown at the same time. And really the model, I think, that we can look at, you know, in this area clearly is prairie. And actually at GLBRC we have a number of experimental plots looking at exactly these kinds of considerations, both here in Wisconsin up at the Arlington Research Center and also at the Kellogg Biological Station over in Michigan. And we can address a number of different issues. You're right, there's a lot of biomass that we can use in a way that really complements and really parallels a lot of the natural cycling in these systems to produce a lot of biomass without a lot of inputs in terms of energy or fertilizers or water. And also really provides a lot of what are known as ecosystem services as well. A lot of diversity there that enhances our natural systems in terms of different types of organisms, nutrient retention, pollution issues as well. And I think Tom has some more he wants to add.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, the GLBRC has five basic thrusts. And the first one that we consider is sustainability. Sustainability in terms of how do we integrate these programs into natural ecosystems in order to maintain biodiversity, in order to have healthy forests, healthy grasslands, to reduce the burden of carbon dioxide in our global environment. And so we start our process by evaluating the sustainability of the systems that we're developing.
All right. Audrey, you want to add anything?
No, I think that I completely agree. We at the GLBRC are very concerned about the sustainability and thinking about these things. And many of us who are involved in different aspects of research in the GLBRC are ultimately trying to incorporate our research in terms of thinking about these things in the long term. So as you mentioned before, my area of research is working on the yeast fermentation. And in the long run, this is one of the things that we would like to think about and incorporate into our research. So very important to us at GLBRC.
Let's go to – thanks again, Kevin, for calling. Appreciate it. And Don in Brownsville, Minnesota, we'll go to you next. Hi, Don.
Hello. I was wondering why your guests kind of concentrate their research on commercial developments or commercial applications rather than development of farm scale. And it seems to me like that would mean a lot more research into methane and recovering the nitrogen and minerals so that this would be sustainable.
All right. Well, fair question. Let's turn to Tom. We'll start with you, Tom Jeffries.
Sure. I think that there's a lot of work that's been done on methane generation. In fact, if you look at their integrated farms in Wisconsin and actually all across the Midwest, where they're using anaerobic digestion to convert animal manures and other organic materials into methane, and yes, that is absolutely an essential part. But at the GLBRC, what we're trying to do is create the technology for the next generation of biomass and the generation after that. We're trying to create crops that have higher productivities, easier digestibilities, greater photosynthetic efficiencies. We're trying to create organisms that help us to convert those crops into higher value fuels more efficiently, because we are probably not that good at actually doing the commercialization, but we're very good at doing the R&D that leads to that commercial development. So what we try to do is we try to work on a scale where we can integrate both with farms through some of the outreach programs and also with industries by collaboration.
Mm-hmm. And John?
Yeah, I just wanted to briefly add, because, you know, I think, you know, as Tom said, the opportunity to produce, you know, energy from the methane that is generated on the farm, you know, I think is significant on the farm scale. But when we look kind of more broadly in terms of the energy needs that we have, you know, as a nation and beyond, when we once again look at, you know, cellulosic biomass, there's just orders of magnitude more potential energy resource out there. I mean, all plant materials have cell walls, and it's that cell wall material which is universal really to all plants that is, you know, is the opportunity that the center is so focused on.
But I think, as Tom kind of said too, there, the fact that you're looking at a big picture thing doesn't necessarily mean that the smaller units are being left behind, because the research that's developed that Audrey, you or anybody else, the other people are working on, I think is going to be applicable in some part to those.
Right. Broad application, we hope, for many of these things.
Yeah.
I'm reminded too that in the early 80s, there was a big emphasis on local farm production of ethanol. And unfortunately, a lot of small farms lost a lot of money with that when the bigger producers came in.
Thanks, Don. Appreciate the call. Barney in Burlington, Wisconsin, it's your turn next, I believe. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was just curious if there are any estimates of how many BTUs, gallons, or the energy content possible from various types of trees, for instance, pine or deciduous, so we could see like what a 40-acre woodlot would be valued at over 100 years or something like that, how much production?
Yeah.
Those are that's an interesting question. Just as a rule of thumb, ethanol has about two-thirds of the energy content of a gallon of gasoline. Methanol has about 50% of the energy content of a gallon of gasoline. In theory, you can produce about 110 gallons of ethanol from a ton of wood, or ag residues. But in practice, it's probably more like about 80 gallons of ethanol per ton. Those are the kinds of rules of thumb that one can use in this. As also, it's important to realize that these are not mom and pop operations. Probably the smallest economically viable cellulosic ethanol production plant is going to be on the order of 25 million gallons per year. As a rule of thumb, it's about $5 per installed gallon capacity for plant capacity. So you're talking $125 million investment, plus all the feedstock that you have to have to run it. So these are not small mom-and-pop operations. They're pretty significant commercial entities. And even with that, you know, you have to be on a fairly large scale before you can begin to produce it economically to compete with existing fuel sources.
At this point.
Yes.
Thanks very much for calling, Marty. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, as we talk biofuels and biofuels research with our three guests today, John Greenler, Audrey Gash, and Tom Jeffries. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. And we have some open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Let's go to Grant in Sauk City next. Grant, hello.
Hi. I'm curious about biomass gasification, where you use pyrolysis to heat the biomass up and produces a gas, and then you basically are left with the carbon part, and then that can be used as a fertilizer. And I'm wondering how you see that fitting into the biofuels equation.
All right. Well, let's turn to John Greenler first.
Well, you know, the majority of the research at GLBRC is focused on the production of ethanol from these cellulosic materials. But at the same time, you know, we are looking at kind of a diversity of options, and this kind of a more, you know, catalytic type of process is something that we do have research on, and there are some significant breakthroughs that are coming through in this area. And we're really trying to move these forward as well. And I think one of the things that this does bring up is that ultimately we're really going to need a kind of a diversity of different types of fuel sources coming from a range of different types of feedstocks. And so, you know, ethanol may be a major source for a period of time, but it may be that as research continues on, we're finding that other types of compounds have you know, more opportunity than ethanol and other processes. And so we're really trying to move, you know, multiple fronts forward in parallel, and this is a good example of one of those.
Okay.
Thermochemical conversion can be, or gasification can be very efficient for some wood stocks, particularly for woody feedstocks, where this is basically similar to the Fischer-Tropsch process that's been used for many, many decades with coal gasification, making synthesis gas, and then converting that into a wide variety of products. And yes, these days what we're seeing is more efficient processes that combine the either gasification or liquefaction process with electrical generation and the capture of the excess heat. So yes, there are efficient ways to do all of these things. I think at this point, the technologies are all out there, and we're trying to find ways to use them and apply them most appropriately for the individual feedstocks, as John said.
And end use as well, yeah.
All right. Thanks, Grant, for calling. Jake in Oshkosh, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Jake.
Hello. I am wondering what developments have occurred with algae, both in the use of it as a biomass, in addition to using it to produce electricity, and I think that I've also heard that you can use it to produce hydrogen directly, although I'm not sure.
All right. Let's see. Who are we going to turn to for that one? Let's go to Audrey.
No, not me. That's not my area of expertise.
All right. We won't go there then. We'll go to Tom.
I'm sorry. I keep coming back here. But, yeah, I used to work on biophotolytic hydrogen. And, yes, it is a process that works. And it could be used in some circumstances. For example, if you had a coal gasification plant that was producing CO2 and then run the CO2 into an alkaline water body that would have algae growing in it and then capture the algae and use the algae for hydrogen production and digest them into methane. You can come up with schemes like that, and they have been investigated by the National Renewable Energy Lab and also in Israel. material for a number of years. There are a number of species of algae that will both make lipids and will make hydrogen directly. You do run into problems in contamination and continuous harvest, and as I mentioned a little bit earlier in the program, you have to get the algae out of the water, which is not a small problem.
Not a small problem. Yeah. I want to go back to Audrey for a minute just because of her work, which is, it's not esoteric. It's just something that most of us aren't that familiar with. And so tell us some more about your research and really what is this project? Is four-year project, isn't it, or five?
Well, with renewal beyond that, we hope. But yeah, 5 years initially.
5 years initially. But go ahead.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about it. But my area of research is really the nitty-gritty of the process, which is understanding how yeast cells do this fermentation, which is converting sugar to ethanol. So all of the production of ethanol is done by these microbes, by yeast. Now, with corn-based or grain ethanol that most people are familiar with, yeast is using a type of sugar called glucose and converting that to ethanol. And yeast cells are naturally really good at this. Mm-hmm. It's why we can use corn-based ethanol right now. What the focus of the GLBRC is to use alternate types of plant material, known as cellulosic material, to make mm-hmm. ethanol. Now, the problem is that these yeast cells aren't very good at converting that type of material to ethanol. And the reason is that much of this plant material is composed of a different type of sugar. So glucose is what's known as a 6-carbon sugar. And much of this plant material is comprised of 5-carbon sugars. Mm-hmm. So it seems like a subtle distinction to us, but it's a big deal to the yeast. The yeast cells cannot use this type of sugar to make ethanol. And so that's a major mm-hmm. problem. And that's really, I would say, one of the major impediments for using cellulosic ethanol on a wide scale to make ethanol. So what we're doing at the GLBRC is trying to understand why it is that yeast cells can't use cellulosic material to make ethanol. And in fact, we're turning to nature to try to address that, because mm-hmm. it turns out there are other types of microbes that can eat plant material. And so we are looking at some other types of species, including some different yeasts that live in the guts of wood-boring beetles. Now, these beetles, very exciting research, and actually Tom is quite involved in this research also. So these beetles live off of fallen trees, and the reason they can do so is that they harbor a type of yeast in their stomachs that can degrade the cellulosic material and make these nutrients available for the beetles. The bad news for biofuel production is this type of yeast doesn't make ethanol. The beetles probably wouldn't appreciate it so much if these yeast were making ethanol in their stomach. So we can't use them for making biofuel, but we can try to understand the process to learn more about how these different species of yeast can convert plant material into nutrients that the beetles can use. And so by learning about this, how this happens in nature, we're hoping to optimize the type of yeast that is very good at making ethanol so that they'll be able to use cellulosic or plant cell wall material to make biofuels.
Now, can you breed yeasts to change their...
You sure can. And so that is one of the things that we're doing. We're looking at a very wide range of different genetic backgrounds or different strains of yeast, and trying to compare how they consume different types of sugars. We're also looking at how they survive different types of stresses that are part of industrial ethanol production. And so we're doing this for two reasons. One, we're trying to look at the range of characteristics that different genetic lines of yeast have, but we can also do essentially selective breeding to optimize the characteristics that we care about.
We just last night got two new genomes from the Joint Genome Institute.
Very exciting.
Yeah, very exciting. One of these beetle yeasts, we got the whole genome last night. We were poring over it and finding lots of new genes, lots of new sugar transporters and enzymes that we hope to be able to use.
How many nucleotide base pairs?
15 million. 15 million base pairs, yeah.
They're going to be busy with a lot of data to pour over.
Oh, my goodness. And I'm thinking about crossbreeding cattle and so forth. And the process, frankly, is probably kind of similar?
Well, we use rather sophisticated molecular tools to actually go in and change the... change the genes that are in this in the organism, put new ones in, deregulate them, change their responses to the tolerance. And then we have at the GLBRC, we're building a tremendous infrastructure for high-throughput screening that will enable us to make large libraries of organisms and then go through them very rapidly to find the very best ones for use for further genetic development.
Yeah.
So the techniques we use are different, but the concepts are the same, essentially. Not that unlike breeding that probably many of your listeners might be familiar with in a farming aspect. We're doing similar approaches in GLBRC for this purpose.
You're not introducing one yeast to another yeast and...
Sometimes they fight.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. They do fight sometimes.
Well, that doesn't sound all that different from any. Oh, my goodness. And a lot of this, your work and so forth, as we're running out of time here, is on the website, I believe. And, John, what's the website address for people who want to learn some more?
Well, probably the easiest thing is just to Google GLBRC or the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, but I do believe it's just www.glbrc.org, I believe, .org.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and all of our lines were filled, and I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but I thank you very much, and hopefully we can have you back and do this again.
Great.
It's a pleasure, Larry.
Thank you very much.
Lots of fun. John Greenler directs the outreach and education for the Great Lakes Biofuels Research Center at UW. Audrey Gash, assistant professor of genetics at UW, who works on yeast fermentation. And Tom Jeffries, USDA professor in bacteriology at UW-Madison and senior scientist at the Forest Products Laboratory. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.